comments and views expressed on this program are the responsibility of those who make them. They do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates. My guest this evening is Dr. Michio Kaku. Unfortunately, in recording the show, the first few minutes have technical errors we were not able to recover. So we pick up in progress with Dr. Michio Kaku. We are back, and we're talking this evening with Dr. Michio Kaku. And before we went away for that break, Dr. Kaku, I mentioned something about black holes, and I want to do that before we get into those many universes that are possible out there. I can't remember who the great debate was. It was between Hawking and another physicist about whether anything escapes from black holes. Who was the other physicist?
Well, there's Thorne and Preskill and other physicists that have bet against Stephen Hawking. And Hawking, by the way, loses most of the time when he bets. He's not a good gambling man. He's a good physicist, though.
I've read quite a bit about, you know, the theories about what is a black hole and what are its properties. And one of the things that we hear commonly is that the mechanisms in formulating a black hole is a collapsed star that becomes so dense and the gravity so great that it pulls everything in and not even light escapes. But I wonder, as I thought about this again as I read your book, I wonder if that is actually all of the story. Perhaps acceleration is part of the mechanism. Because if things speed up in a black hole, and if it's possible, I don't know if it's possible, but if they speed up beyond the speed of light, would that not create the blackness of the black hole?
If you cross the point of no return, called the event horizon, then you plunge directly into the center of the black hole and you die. And why can't you come back out again? The reason why you can't come back out again is because you would have to go faster than the speed of light to reverse yourself and come out of the event horizon. So the event horizon is like a Roach Motel. Everything checks in and you never check out. And why don't you check out? Because the roaches would have to go faster than the speed of light to get out, and that's not possible. That's why a black hole is a one-way street. However, I should point out that our idea of a black hole has changed recently. We see them. We see them in the Milky Way galaxy, wandering black holes in our sector of the galaxy. We see them everywhere, and they're all spinning very rapidly. And when a black hole spins rapidly, it doesn't collapse to a dot. That's the old picture. The new picture is that it collapses to a ring of neutrons spinning very rapidly. And amazingly enough, if you fall through the ring, you don't die. If you fall through the ring, gravity is finite, and you fall through the ring and you go through the looking glass, you wind up on a parallel universe. The mathematics is quite clear. A black hole, a spinning black hole, is a gateway to another universe.
And that brings us to our discussion of the universes. I saw you on television talking about and using the same example or similar example as used in the book about universes and membranes and so forth, like bubbles.
Yeah, we think that our universe is a soap bubble of some sort. We live on the skin of the bubble. We're like flies stuck on flypaper. We can't leave our bubble universe. We think it's expanding, but we now believe that there are other universes out there. There are big bangs happening all the time. Even as we began this conversation, universes have been created, and this is called the multiverse idea. At first, it was considered a crackpot idea, but now it's mainstream theoretical physics. There are hundreds of physics papers written on the multiverse idea. So our universe becomes a membrane, a brain, as we shorten it, floating with other brains, and maybe they bump into each other. Maybe they split into two brains. This is an area of enormous interest. Hundreds of scientific papers are being written in this area, all of which tell us that you can go back before creation, back before the Big Bang. Now, that was also thought to be impossible. How can you possibly understand anything that goes back before the creation itself? Well, in 2014, we're going to launch a satellite that will detect gravity wave radiation emitted from the instant of creation, and that should have a fingerprint of the world before the instant of creation. So watch for it. In the middle of the next decade, we're going to probe not just the Big Bang, but the universe before it was born.
That's a mind blower. It really is. Now, a few years ago, I read an article, and I cannot, I looked for it, I can't find it, but it was called The Big Blowout. And it talked about a theory very similar to what you're saying, that actually our universe may have been a rupture in the side of another universe, and it all blew out of there.
Yeah, this is being taken very seriously now. In fact, if you get the recent Discover magazine, it's on the front cover of the recent Discover magazine, we think there could be something called the multiverse where universes bud or sprout from other universes. Just like plants will sprout, branches will sprout from other branches. They'll bud, they'll sprout. Universes can do the same thing. And that is one way to explain the origin of our universe, that it budded from a parent universe. Or at Princeton, I have friends of mine who believe what is called the Big Splat Theory, that two membranes collided with each other to give us the Big Bang and the universe. So I tell you, man, this is really hot area for publication. Anyone interested in making a name for themselves can write in a field that is very, very teeming with activity right now, the pre-Big Bang universe.
Have you come to any conclusions, or are you still wide open on how it happened?
I'm still wide open. Right now, if you look at the data now, okay, let's not get too far into outer space, but look at the data. We have baby pictures of the Big Bang. Some people don't believe in the Big Bang. It's a free country. You can not believe anything you want. But we have photographs of it now. In the microwave range, our satellites have taken pictures of the embers of the explosion, which are still ricocheting around the universe in the microwave region. So we have baby pictures of the infant universe when it was about 300,000 years old. But as I mentioned, in the next decade, we're going to get photographs of the universe just as it was coming out of the womb. At the instant of creation, we're going to get gorgeous photographs in the next decade with our satellites. Satellite is called LISA, by the way. NASA is funding it right now. And maybe we'll have evidence of an umbilical cord. Maybe we'll see evidence of an umbilical cord connecting our baby universe to a parent universe. That's what Stephen Hawking calls them, by the way, baby universes. So our universe may have been a baby universe that sprouted from a mother universe.
You know, the problem that I have with the notion of the Big Bang is the typical high school science class notion that out of nothing there was an explosion. I don't buy spontaneous generation. I just simply don't. It had to have come from somewhere. And what you're talking about makes sense. It came from somewhere.
Right. And if you want to look in the literature, the physics literature, this is sometimes also called chaotic inflation. Inflation, my friend Alan Guth proposed it. He may very well win the Nobel Prize for that theory called inflation. Inflation talks about this multiverse, this continual budding, sprouting of baby universes all the time. And our universe is just, you know, possibly one among many universes that have sprouted. And we think we're the only one. But maybe we're not. Now, for me, this is aesthetically pleasing because there are two religions that talk about creation. One is Genesis, the Judeo-Christian theory of Genesis, but the other is Buddhism, which says there is no beginning, there's no end, there's only nirvana. Now we can meld these two ideas into a single theory. Yes, there was a Big Bang, but the Big Bang took place in an ocean of nirvana, and bubbles are popping in nirvana all the time. So we have a new theory called continual genesis. So we meld Buddhism with Judeo-Christian thinking this way.
You know, there is... I'm not going to get into this much, but I will just mention that if you read the words as opposed to the theologies, the words themselves read like a Star Wars script.
It does. In fact, the words we use, this nirvana I'm talking about is shorthand for 11-dimensional hyperspace. So this larger arena almost sounds like something from Star Trek. This larger arena where universes are born and die, that's hyperspace.
How big is it?
Well, let me give you an example. When I was a child, I used to go to San Francisco, the Japanese Tea Garden, and I used to look at the carp swimming just beneath the pond. I used to spend hours looking at the carp. And then I said to myself, what would it be like to be a fish? If I was a fish, I would live in a two-dimensional pond. I could swim forward, backward, left, right. But the concept of up into the third dimension, that was outrageous. There's nothing beyond the pond. And then I imagined there was a fish down there, a scientist fish. And the scientist fish would say, bah, humbug. There's no world of up. There's no such thing as a third dimension. There's no such thing as hyperspace. There's only the pond. What you see is what there is. End of story, period. And then I imagine reaching down and grabbing the scientist fish, lifting the fish into the third dimension, hyperspace. What would the fish see? The fish would see beings breathing without water, a new law of biology. Beings moving without fins, a new law of physics. Well, today, we now believe, we physicists believe, that we are the fish. We spend all our time in three dimensions, going forward, backward, left, right, up, down. But anyone who dares to talk about a higher dimension, a world of up, a world of hyperspace, is considered a crackpot. Well, not anymore.
When you say not anymore, is the idea of 10 or 11 dimensions, I've heard both numbers. I'll ask this question. We'll have to get to the answer on the other side of this break. But is the idea becoming really mainstream? We'll be back right after this break.
Old enough to die. When the future's getting old, we'll forget Did you know the Kevin Smith Show selects one of its very best shows each week and turns it into a free podcast? Well, it's true. You can download free Kevin Smith Show podcast right now and get a free fresh podcast each week. Do you want to start building your own library of Kevin Smith Shows? All you have to do is visit our website at kevinsmithshow.com and click the free podcast link. They're yours for the download. We are back, and we are talking with Dr. Michio Kaku about the world of physics and, indeed, the world itself. Before the break, Doctor, I asked the question, how mainstream is it? Now, I want to tell you why I asked that question. It is my opinion. I could be wrong. But there is a group of scientists, various fields of science, that I call establishment scientists. And they defend the status quo virtually no matter what. And I have said that history has shown status quo scientists tend to be wrong most of the time. They are the ones who gave us the flat earth. They are the ones who gave us the terracentric universe. And it's the guys who break out of that and look at things and say, well, why not? Let's try this. Let's see what happens here. Those are the people that make the progress. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that is my opinion. Now, having said that, there are still people writing, a few people writing and chuckling about 10 dimensions. So how mainstream has it become?
Well, the ultimate criterion is not popularity. The ultimate criterion is experiment. And as I mentioned, in May of this year, the Large Hadron Collider, the biggest machine of science ever built, costing 8 billion euros, is going to be turned on. And we're going to test the periphery of string theory. This machine is so big, it is 17 miles in circumference. You could put the city of Geneva inside the machine. It took all of Europe to fund this machine. Our machine, by the way, was canceled. It was to be built outside Dallas, Texas, but Congress canceled our machine back in 1993. Now the Europeans are taking the forefront, and we're going to be testing aspects of string theory. String theory predicts, for example, that we may be able to get mini black holes. They're not dangerous, but microscopic black holes to be created. Also, sparticles. Sparticles are superparticles that are predicted by string theory. They represent a higher vibration of the string. So that is the ultimate arbiter, which is experiment. And the Europeans are betting 8 billion euros, okay? You're talking about $12 billion. $12 billion betting that this machine will begin to test the periphery of theories like string theory. This is big business now.
Well, yeah, $12 billion is, in anybody's book, that's big business. Now, let me ask this. If it turns out that everything, that string theory is proven to be correct, and probably it will be proven to, or shown to be correct, maybe with some modification here and there, a little tweaking as the experiments are done. But it's shown to be correct. Would it be possible then to think in terms of, then if we change the rate of vibration, we change the properties of matter?
Yes, when you change the vibrations of the string, one particle turns into another. An electron can turn into a quark, or a quark can turn into a W boson. We're talking about different melodies, different frequencies of the string, corresponding to a difference of atomic particles. And that explains why we have so many of them. You know, we have thousands of subatomic particles that we've cataloged. It cost us billions of dollars to do this. And Oppenheimer, J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb,
sure.
He was so frustrated that there's so many subatomic particles that back in the 50s, he announced that the Nobel Prize in Physics should go to the physicist who does not discover a new particle that year. Today, we can summarize, we think, almost all these particles as nothing but music. Music. Music seems to be the language of Mother Nature in describing the fundamental forces of the world.
All right. Now, if it becomes possible to actually change the vibration of the string, thereby changing the type of particles that we see and experience, then that will be physicists, in broad terms, having done what was the goal of alchemy.
In some sense, except the alchemists didn't go far enough. You know, they wanted to turn lead into gold.
Yeah.
Today, we can actually do that. We can do that with our atom smashers. You can take lead, hit it with a beam of protons, and you can turn it into gold. But it's a very expensive way to do that. The gold that you get would be a fraction of the cost of simply going to Fort Knox and exchanging it for real gold there. But here, we're talking about a different kind of gold. We're talking about the ultimate substance out of which the universe was created. The Large Hadron Collider, this huge atom smasher, is a genesis machine. Its purpose is to create a mini Big Bang outside Geneva, Switzerland. And again, in two months it's going to be turned on. And by creating a mini genesis, a mini Big Bang, we hope to unlock the secret of the universe itself. That's what it's all about.
One of the more esoteric questions I have on my page here has to do with that. Let's imagine that we do a genesis. We do a Big Bang successfully.
Mm-hmm.
A mini bang. Okay? It happens. Would it be possible that all of us and everything we're doing actually exist in someone's Hadron Collider?
You mean like in that last scene in Men in Black?
Yeah.
Camera zooms away and we wind up as an atom inside someone's golf ball?
Yeah.
It's possible, except with our telescopes. We've looked out there, and we've reconstructed by computer a pretty good simulation of what it's like to go about 10 billion light years from the Earth. And the universe looks kind of lumpy, but it's still pretty uniform outside of the lumps. So we don't see any structure. You know, we don't see worlds within worlds like you see in science fiction movies sometimes that maybe our galaxy is an atom, and the galaxy is an atom in a molecule of other galaxies. We've looked for these things, and we really, really don't see much. However, we think that even beyond that, our entire universe may be a golf ball, in which case there are other balls out there, other universes. That may be possible. That, in fact, is the leading theory right now that we're looking at very carefully. Many, many papers being written on the subject, but a multiverse. And then people come up to me and ask me a simple question. Is Elvis Presley still alive in one of these universes? Well, believe it or not, the answer is maybe. You know, it only takes one cosmic ray to create a quantum difference between two universes. That's a small quantum event. But if a cosmic ray goes through Hitler's mother may have had a miscarriage and never gave birth to Hitler, in which case, in this parallel universe, World War II did not take place. Or for that matter, maybe a cosmic ray goes through Roosevelt's mother, in which case we're speaking German right now. It kind of like boggles the mind, but you can't rule it out. You can't rule out this bizarre idea that there are parallel universes very similar to our own universe.
How far away is the next universe, or how close is it?
Well, it's as close as your living room, believe it or not, okay? First of all, everything is vibrating. We can measure these vibrations. The quantum theory is based on that fact. But each universe that vibrates spits off other universes. So the universe splits apart. And these other universes no longer beat in vibration with our universe. That's called decoherence. And so we don't interact with them anymore. But these other universes could be just as real, and they could be in your living room. Think of a radio. A radio can tune into Radio Moscow, Radio Paris, or whatever, and you can get a lot of frequencies on your radio, but you have decohered from those other frequencies. You only pick up your local rock station. But in your living room, you coexist with many, many frequencies from other radio stations. In the same way, in your living room, excuse me, I have a cold. In your living room could be the wave function of dinosaurs. There could be the wave function of aliens. There could be the wave function of pirates. And our universe decohered, no longer vibrates with these universes, and we can't touch them. But we exist in the same living room as these other universes. Now, this is a bizarre idea, but Nobel Prize winners have presented this idea. Steve Weinberg, in his book, Winner of the Nobel Prize, has defended this point of view, and I think he's right. We coexist with parallel universes in our living room.
Well, and we have our top of the hour break coming, and then we've got a good long time before we have another break. But if that's the case, it could be, if not the answer, it could certainly be one of the answers to a lot of the UFO phenomena, in that, that we may be going through a period of time where, for some reason, we are able to see into another universe, or maybe they are able to bump into our universe a little bit, and maybe that's what we're seeing, and maybe they're not from across billions of light years. Maybe they're just already here and we're seeing them. We'll talk about that when we come back,
okay.
All right? All right, folks, it's top of the hour, and we'll be back with Dr. Michio Kaku right after this.
Nowhere, somewhere, anywhere. And when I'm lonely, I can always close my eyes and see her face. And when I'm all alone, I know I've got a love I can't replace. Can't you see? Somewhere anywhere.
Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
Welcome to all of you who are joining us just now in this second hour of the Kevin Smith Show. I'm delighted that you have joined with us. We're talking with Dr. Michio Kaku. We already have callers on hold, but I want to get a response from Dr. Kaku about my speculation. The speculation was that because of these many universes and their existing really right where I am, they're all around us. That being the case, is it possible that could be responsible for some of the UFO phenomena?
It's possible. We physicists have tried to rank these theoretical advanced civilizations into categories, and then we can talk about how they might reach us. We have type 1, type 2, type 3 civilizations. Type 1 civilizations are planetary. They consume the energy of an entire planet. They control the weather. They control volcanoes and earthquakes. Type 2 controls stars and stellar energy, like Star Trek, the Federation of Planets, and Captain Kirk. Type 3 is galactic. They control the galactic space lanes, just like the Empire of the Empire Strikes Back. If you are a Type 2, or preferably a Type 3 civilization, you're so advanced that you could actually open gateways, perhaps open a gateway, a portal between universes, and just like Alice going through the looking glass, walk through the looking glass from one universe to the next. You wouldn't even need a UFO. You would simply open a doorway between two universes. And that is what an advanced civilization like a Type 3 civilization may take advantage of, drilling holes in space-time.
Would they be able to get back to their point of origin?
Yes. As I mentioned before, a black hole is a one-way trip. You can go through the Kerr ring, as we call it, but it's a one-way trip. But in the 1980s at Caltech, physicists found a transversible wormhole, a wormhole where you could freely go back and forth between universes and not suffer the consequences.
All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
Oh, this is Chris from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yes, Chris.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Doctor, I just want to say it's an absolute pleasure, sir, to have you with us tonight.
Oh, well, thank you.
I had a quick question, and then I'll listen to the answer offline. Isn't the ability to possibly work out the string theory in the super collider, in essence, you're saying you're generating a universe, if you will, but on a much smaller scale, resonating at a different vibration than what our current universes, correct?
Well, sort of. We're talking about slamming protons together at about 15 trillion electron volts. That's much hotter than the surface of the sun or even in the interior of the sun. And we hope to create a quark gluon plasma, which is what the radiation of the Big Bang was all about. So it's a mini Big Bang.
Okay. Now, I'm just curious now, does the frequencies that things are resonating at, I know you spoke of it being played like music, just like any other music, if an instrument's out of tune with another one, there's a clashing and there's an obvious discord. Is it possible that with two existing like that, that there would be a clash?
Well, when two things vibrate in unison, that's called coherence, and then they can exchange information between each other. It's called quantum entanglement when two objects vibrate in unison. When they no longer vibrate in unison, that's called decoherence.
I thought it was called divorce.
That's true, too. But when electrons no longer vibrate in unison, it's called decoherence. And when universes no longer vibrate in unison, they decohere, and they don't interact with each other anymore. So they can exist in your living room with you, except you cannot interact with them anymore because you've decohered from that wave function. So instead of simply clashing, you no longer interact with them at all.
Gotcha. Well, very interesting. I know I said I'd listen off air, but you answered it, so I really appreciate it, sir.
Thanks for the call.
You have a wonderful night.
All right, folks, the telephone number toll-free throughout North America is 1-800-289-1092. 1-800-289-1092. And if you are outside of North America and you want to participate in the discussion, just send me an email. Send it to flash@kevinsmithshow.com. We call it Flash because when the message comes in, I get a little flashing notice on my screen, all right? So send it to flash@kevinsmithshow.com. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Mickey from Atlanta. Long time, first time.
Are you a first time caller?
Yeah, well, yes, I am, as a matter of fact.
All right, let's give you a little applause here. Okay, Mickey from Atlanta, go ahead.
All right, Dr. Kaku, what a pleasure it is to speak with you tonight. I just got a brief question. I'll ask it, and I'll hang up and take your answer.
Okay.
When the results of the French Corot and our Kepler satellites and their search for Earth-like planets, when the results become substantial, you suggested last year that this might make it easier for SETI to search for radio signals from intelligent life.
Right.
Now, since the SETI search has been spectacularly unsuccessful since Dr. Mm-hmm. Mike Drake began it in 1960, what approach would you suggest searchers use once we've established a narrowed list of suspects? Thank you so much. I'll hang up and take your answer.
Okay. Well, we have two things coming up. One is a generation of satellites that will detect up to 600 Earth-like twins in outer space. You mentioned Kepler going up in orbit this year. The French Corot satellite already went up in orbit, but it's a smaller satellite. Once we detect twins of the Earth in outer space, not only will we have an existential shock knowing that the evening sky, the familiar constellations of the evening sky, have twins of the Earth in them, not only are we going to have a shock, but there's going to be funding to then listen in on conversations between these potential planets. Paul Allen, the Microsoft billionaire, has now donated $26 million to the SETI project to build scores of radio telescopes outside Hat Creek, north of San Francisco. So this is a 1-2 punch. First, Kepler zeroes in on perhaps hundreds of Earth-like planets in outer space. Two, the Allen radio array zeroes in on these planets and listens for conversations, perhaps, between these alien civilizations. So now this is serious business. SETI has never been funded very well. It's always been haphazard. But now we have the potential of injecting millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars from this millionaire, billionaire in fact, in order to listen in on potential conversations. And even then, if we don't hear anything, we have to realize that we're only scanning a nearby vicinity of the Earth in its orbit around the Milky Way galaxy. There's billions of galaxies out there that we have not even begun to scan yet. So it doesn't rule it out, intelligent life, but I think we're going to get very close to it in the next coming years.
Well, that brings up this question. If there are intelligent species out there, and provided that they are highly advanced technologically and able to travel at the speed of light or beyond, wouldn't radio be far into their past?
Probably you're right. In physics of the impossible, I mentioned the fact that we could be listening in on the wrong frequency. For example, if you're walking down a country road and you bump into an anthill, do you go down to the ants and say, I bring you trinkets, I bring you beads, take me to your leader? Or maybe you step on a few of them. Ants are so primitive, they cannot communicate with us. And if there's a 10-lane superhighway being built right next to the anthill, would the ants be able to pick up Earth frequencies? Would the ants be able to understand what a 10-lane superhighway is? Would the ants be able to communicate with us? And the answer is no. They're so primitive, they wouldn't know what frequencies we use. They wouldn't even know what we're doing, for God's sake. So if a civilization is that advanced, we may not even know what their intentions are, and we may not even know what frequencies they use.
if indeed they're even using frequencies. They may be using something we know nothing about.
Right. Even something as simple as laser beams. If they're using laser beams to communicate, we would never know using our current devices.
And we're just now beginning to get into quantum physics. I know there have been great advances, but, I mean, really, what there is to know is a universe compared to what we do know. Maybe they're using some sort of quantum method of communication that we know nothing about as yet.
Yeah, it's always possible, and that's why you can't rule out intelligent life just because we don't pick up any signals from outer space. And my particular point of view is that if they're that advanced, that they can go between stars, if they're that advanced, they are already thousands of years ahead of us, in which case they may look at our radio as a horse and buggy.
Yeah, I made the statement, within the last couple of weeks, I made the statement on this show and got a lot of negative email. Well, I got some negative email about it, that if there are alien races visiting this planet, they obviously are much more advanced than we are, and I would think if I were one of those alien races looking at us, I would look at us and say, that's a bunch of knuckle-draggers here.
Yeah,
in comparison to them, you know.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. For example, sometimes people say that if time travel is possible, then where are the tourists from the future? Well, why are we so interesting that they're going to want to come and visit us? We're so primitive. I mean, would you go back and look at a dinosaur have lunch? Well, maybe the first time, but after 100 lunches of looking at dinosaurs, you get bored, and you're not going to want to go back and see dinosaurs eat lunch. So why are we so great that they're going to want to visit us and want to interact with us? We may be too primitive. We may offer them nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, when we talk about time travel, I've read that one theory is that it's possible that you could travel backward in time but not forward. Now, that being the case, if you could travel back in time, you could not come back to your point of origin because you'd be moving forward.
See, going forward in time, our astronauts do that when they go in orbit. When they come back after about a year, they're like, I don't know, something like a millisecond ahead of us in time. So going forward in time is possible if you go near the speed of light. To go backwards in time, to meet your teenage mother before you're born, that's really hard. However, we think that with the wormhole, even that may be possible. But again, we're talking about the energy of a black hole. So to tie time into knots, to make space be bent into a pretzel, would require vast amounts of energy comparable to a star.
Well, yeah, but even stars don't bend it all into a pretzel, do they?
You need a black hole. Black holes are so intense that light going around the event horizon almost turns into spaghetti. It just wraps around. And so the gravitational pull is so intense that as you get closer to the black hole, you eventually hit the point of no return. So a black hole definitely can bend time into ribbons. The question is whether or not you can go through it and survive. That's not known.
Let's talk about light for a minute. You brought it up about light and black holes. So let's talk about that. What is light?
Well, the old picture of light was that light is nothing but electric fields turning into magnetic fields, turning into electric fields, and it creates a wave that travels at the speed of light. That was the picture that James Maxwell wrote down around 1860. And that's been pretty much the way we view light ever since. There's a new way of looking at light, though, and that is its vibrations in the fifth dimension. Remember I said that when I was a child, I used to visit the Japanese tea garden, looking at the fish swimming in a two-dimensional pond. Well, one day it rained, and I saw the raindrops falling on the pond. And then I realized that it is possible for the fish to understand that there is a universe beyond the pond. And that is, they can see ripples. Ripples moving on the surface of a two-dimensional world. So ripples on the surface of a two-dimensional world act like light. Now, if you take Einstein's equations, ripple a higher dimension, and look at the equations, what do you get? You get exactly the theory of Maxwell, written down in 1860. So the simplest theory of light is that light is a vibration of the fifth dimension. It works. In fact, every graduate student in physics getting their PhD goes through an existential shock, realizing that the simplest interpretation of light is that it's just ripples on the surface of a Japanese tea garden.
Okay. Now, one of the things that we, most of us, were taught, either in high school or in college science classes, is that the speed of light is constant. But that really isn't true, is it?
Well, it slows down when you hit glass, and it slows down when you hit different kinds of substances like diamonds and water. But in a vacuum, we see no deviation. Einstein was right on this. We don't see no deviation. In a vacuum, light travels at the speed of light. In fact, all electronics is based on this. The internet, GPS, laser beams, they're all based on the idea that in a vacuum, light travels at the same velocity.
Okay, but if its speed is a product of its nature, a product, or I don't know, if it's one of its properties, then it would seem to me that the scientists, I believe it was in Canada, who slowed it down almost to a stop in cesium, it would seem that you could not do that if that was part of its properties. It would cease to be light once it is slowed down virtually to a stop.
Yeah, but that was not done in a vacuum. If you take light and put it in molasses, it'll slow down. But a molasses is not a vacuum. In a vacuum, light travels at the speed of light. So if you look at these press releases very carefully, the fine print, you realize that they trap light in a substance. That's the trick. Uh-huh. If you put light in a vacuum, it travels at the speed of light. Even they would say that.
But if space is mostly dark energy and dark matter, then it's not really in a vacuum, is it?
Well, a vacuum is a state of so-called nothing. That is, there's no matter. Light travels at the speed of light in that vacuum. However, we now realize that that vacuum has energy associated with this. This result is only about 5 years old, but the WMAP satellite currently orbiting the Earth has given us pretty much conclusive evidence that even emptiness contains a certain amount of energy, and that energy is repulsive, which means that the galaxies are being blown away from each other. And that, of course, means that the universe is accelerating, not slowing down, but accelerating. And this may eventually kill the universe. It's going to be awfully cold in the future. All of it due to the fact that even nothingness has energy associated with it.
All right, but what about dark matter?
Dark matter is ordinary matter that is invisible. We think it's a higher vibration of the string. Well, there are two theories. One is that if you take a string, give it more energy, it becomes invisible, and that's dark matter. There is another theory, though, which is rather ingenious, proposed actually by a student of mine. If I take two sheets of paper, and I put the invisible man on one sheet of paper, and you are on the second sheet of paper, he's invisible. He's invisible because he's floating above you in a parallel universe. Now, let's say that you can feel his gravity. This means that you would feel the gravity of something, but there's nothing there because he's floating above you in hyperspace. That could be dark matter. The alternate theory of dark matter is that it's ordinary matter hovering above us in hyperspace. Just like The Invisible Man. If you read H.G. Wells' novel, The Invisible Man, very carefully, he did not get invisibility by the chemical explosion. He got invisibility through the fourth dimension.
All right. So it's close enough to coherence that we can detect its presence. It's decoherent just enough that we cannot see it.
Oh, you're talking about parallel universes, right?
Yeah, if this matter is ordinary matter, but in another universe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it would be just enough coherent to detect its presence.
Well, gravity seeps between sheets of paper, so that the Invisible Man lives on one sheet of paper, you live on another sheet of paper below him, and in between there's gravity. So gravity can flow between, which means that this Invisible Man would have gravity, but no presence. And that's what dark matter is. Dark matter is gravity, but there's nothing there. It's invisible.
Recently, the mainstream media, science reporters, reported that scientists had discovered that there are strands or bands of gravity that flow between all the bodies in the universe, and that these bands of matter, which they described as, if you think of it as a long rubber band or an elastic band, flow between us and the sun, and it's along those bands of gravity that the energy and particles flow that create the aurora borealis.
Well, the sun has a north pole and a south pole that flip every 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
So every 11 years, the north pole and the south pole flip, believe it or not. That releases a burst of energy, and that burst of energy can wipe out satellites. That's why the radiation is quite dangerous. And every 11 years, we have to tell our astronauts and telecommunications satellite owners to protect your satellites, protect your astronauts, because the solar wind and radiation from the 11-year sunspot cycle could very well damage your equipment. And the aurora borealis is nothing but one small side effect of this effect. The big one, though, is that the sunspots release this burst of energy just like a rifle aimed at the Earth. The last time it erupted was several years ago, and I still remember one of our astronauts was told to go into the cargo bay because there's extra protection there, because a gamma ray from the sun may hit him. So this is definitely one of the hazards of the space age.
What I was thinking about there with the bands of gravity is that you were talking about gravity flowing between the two pieces of paper. With the scientists in this report saying that they had discovered that there are these bands of gravity along which the particles flow. That's between us and the sun. It's not a far leap then to see if that happens between us and the sun, between us and the moon, and they said these bands of gravity connect everything in the galaxy and in the universe. It's not a far leap to understand that you could have those same bands of gravity between this universe and other universes.
Well, I'm not familiar with this theory. But the current theory is that if I have these two parallel sheets of paper and you have a galaxy in one sheet of paper hovering above you, that you would feel its presence, but you would not see it, because light goes beneath this galaxy hovering above you, and so it would become a dark galaxy. And believe it or not, dark galaxies exist. 2 years ago on the Internet, they flashed a picture of a dark galaxy. It's totally dark. There are no stars there. We know it's there because it bends light, but there's no stars there. It's a galaxy made totally out of invisible dark matter. So I heard about it. I rushed home. I wanted to see it. I got on the Internet, downloaded the photograph, and of course I was disappointed because the photograph was all black. Of course it's black, I said to myself. It's invisible. But there it was, the outline, the faint outline you could see of a dark galaxy.
All right. Now, I also recently read that scientists, astronomers, had found a big section of our universe where there's nothing.
It's
a big hole.
Yeah.
Is that a possible point at which maybe our universe is already sort of blown out into another universe?
Well, the leading theory of the voids is that when the Big Bang took place, dark matter began to clump. Dark matter clumps pretty rapidly. And as it began to clump, matter, ordinary matter, which does not like to clump so much, slowly began to clump where the dark matter already clumped. So then, what is dark matter? If you simply take the string and take a higher vibration of the string turns invisible. And so we think that's what dark matter is. So out of the Big Bang came heavy vibrations of the string, which are invisible, and they clumped together. And then ordinary matter began to then condense around the clumpiness of dark matter. And that's why we have gorgeous maps of dark matter now on the Internet. It's invisible, but the Hubble Space Telescope can, quote, see dark matter in the same way that you can see your eyeglasses. Your eyeglasses are invisible. So how can you see your eyeglasses? Because your eyeglasses distort light. That's exactly what dark matter does, distort light. So we now have gorgeous maps of dark matter, and sure enough, it's clumpy, just like we predicted, and that ordinary matter clumps along with the dark matter. And that seems to be the structure of the universe on a big scale, clumpiness with galaxies inside.
All right, we have to take a break. We will be back in just a little bit. We'll continue with Dr. Michio Kaku, and we'll continue with your telephone calls. If you have a question for Dr. Kaku, the telephone number is 1-800-289-1092. Or if you have a comment, that's toll-free throughout North America. Or you can send us, if you live outside of North America, a flash message. Send it to flash@kevinsmithshow.com.
And he says, Get it all. Become a member at kevinsmithshow.com.
Call Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
We are back. We are talking this evening with Dr. Michio Kaku. The telephone number, toll-free throughout all of North America, is 1-800-289-1092. And if you have a comment or question, that's the number to call, all right? You will have the opportunity to ask your question of one of the great minds in on the whole planet, and I would say in this universe, and maybe in several universes. I'm not sure how that works. But this is your opportunity. And if you're outside of North America, send me a flash message. Send it to flash@kevinsmithshow.com. Now, Doctor, I want to go back to your book here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, we've been doing a lot of talking about the multiverse concept. And in that section of your book, well, let me just read this from your book. This is from page 240 and 241. It says, apparently our universe lives in a Goldilocks zone of many parameters, all of which are fine-tuned to allow for life. So either we are left with the conclusion that there is a God of some sort who has chosen our universe to be just right to allow for life, or there are billions of parallel universes, many of them dead. As Freeman Dyson has said, quote, the universe seemed to know we were coming, end quote. I like that. But let me ask you, is what we are discovering exclusive of God? Now, before you answer, let me tell you, I'm not a religious person. I just would like to know if what we're learning in science is exclusive of there being a God.
Well, when I was in second grade, my second grade teacher walked in one day and said that God so loved the earth that he put the earth just right from the sun. Not too close, the oceans would boil. Not too far, the oceans would freeze. And I thought to myself, wow, that's a pretty neat argument. Maybe the teacher is right. Well, now we have discovered almost 300 planets orbiting other stars. They are too close, they are too far, and they have no liquid oceans and probably no life. So instead of saying that the Earth is in the Goldilocks zone from the sun, therefore there is a loving God, there is another way of looking at it. There are dead Earths. There are dead planets out there. Now, our universe seems to be fine-tuned to allow for life. If the nuclear force were stronger, the sun would have burnt out and become a cinder, and we wouldn't be here. If the nuclear force were too weak, the sun would never ignite, and the universe would be dark. There'd be no stars. So the nuclear force is tuned just right to allow the Earth. Same thing for the electric force. Same thing for the gravitational force. Does that mean there's a God because the Earth is tuned just right for many, 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 many Goldilocks zones? Well, the alternate point of view is there are dead universes. There are universes where the sun never ignites. There are universes where the sun burns out too quickly. They're just dead universes. We happen to be in a universe where there is life, and that's why we can talk about us being in the Goldilocks zone. This is called the anthropic principle. The strong anthropic principle says, well, God exists. The weak anthropic principle says, well, maybe there are dead universes.
Would you say that the two concepts are mutually exclusive?
Not necessarily. It just means that science allows for the possibility that you can explain the fact that we live in so many different Goldilocks zones, we are just right in so many ways. You can explain that by simply saying that it's luck, that there are other universes which are not so lucky, and there's no life in them. They exist as oceans of electrons with no atoms, oceans of neutrinos, no complex chemicals, no life, no DNA.
Well, I'm moving from the macro to the micro here, sort of. I'm moving that direction. And this is what I wanted to get to. There's a big debate yet in science as to what consciousness is. There are many, many theories about what consciousness is. You point out in your book that humans seem to have the capability of thinking and conscious behavior way beyond what is necessary for survival. It would seem to be self-evident that there is consciousness. On the other hand, it is anything but self-evident as to what consciousness is.
Yeah. Well, in the book, Physics of the Impossible, which, by the way, as I said before, hit number 18 on the New York Times bestseller list just this week, there's several ways of looking at it. If consciousness is self-awareness, then a thermostat has a certain amount of self-awareness. A thermostat measures the temperature around itself and adjusts itself. A bug can be said to be slightly conscious. Bugs also monitor their environment. They also adjust themselves accordingly. So one thing you could say is that perhaps there are degrees of consciousness. We happen to be off scale, but there are other things in the universe. There are dogs, cats, rabbits. They're aware to some degree. And so self-awareness may not be just for us. Now, we are so off scale, then the question is, why did evolution make us smarter than we have to be to survive in the forest? To survive in the forest, you just have to be a big monkey. But, you know, we can dream about starships. No, we can build radios and televisions. Why are we so smart? Well, we think there's an arms race. An arms race, perhaps people versus people. We don't know, but an arms race that made us so smart, much smarter than we have to be.
All right. Now, moving back to the macro, moving that direction, it's obvious that there is something that we call consciousness. And as you say, other animals exhibit certain degrees of consciousness. It is entirely possible that as smart as we are, that there are species, races of intelligent life out in the universe that would look at us in some way similar to the way we look at the intelligence of dolphins.
Yeah, I agree.
So it's important, I think, and I'd like to get your take on this. It's important for us, as smart as we are, to always remind ourselves we're really not that smart yet.
Right. And also, in my book, Physics of the Impossible, I have a whole chapter about robots.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, are robots conscious? Can they be more conscious than us? Can they be smarter than us? And I say, well, in principle, yes. Computer power will probably seal off pretty soon. We know we're hitting the end of silicon. But perhaps beyond that, we'll have quantum computers, in which case, if computer power keeps on growing into the coming decades, perhaps one day we will have conscious robots, conscious machines. At that point, they could be dangerous. So in my book, I advocate that either we put a chip in their brain to shut them off if they become murderous, or we think about merging with them. And if we ever meet intelligent life in outer space, chances are they made their decision centuries ago. The decision whether or not to fight the machine or merge with the machine. And realize that if your choice is either dying or living forever as a cyborg of some sort, as a superhuman cyborg, I think a lot of people would opt for that kind of enhancement rather than death.
Do you think we will actually get there?
It's conceivable. I think within a century, assuming that we can continue to increase computer power, which is, of course, not clear at all, but assuming that we could do that, we could probably hit near human intelligence, in which case we will be able to genetically modify our bodies. Genetic enhancement is possible. For example, we've already found genes for good memory in mice, and also the Mighty Mouse gene, the gene that gives you big muscles. We found both in mice. They have counterparts in the human genome. So in the future, parents may want to have designer children. And as the decades go by, perhaps we will have a choice. Live longer, be healthier, stronger, better looking, and maybe with mechanical implants, live longer. And aliens from outer space, when we bump into them, we should not be surprised if they are self-made. That if they have genetically modified themselves and modified themselves as cyborgs. We shouldn't be shocked if that happens.
What do you think of the possibility or the probability that there are intelligent extraterrestrial civilizations?
Well, I think it's 100%. I mean, take a look at the number of galaxies that we can see with a telescope. It's 100 billion. Each galaxy, in turn, contains 100 billion stars. So you now know how many stars there are in the visible universe. 100 billion times 100 billion. That is the total number of stars in the visible universe. To think that we're the only one that's intelligent, I think that's the height of arrogance. Of course they're out there. The only question is, can they reach us?
All right, we have to pause for a break, and when we come back from this break, we will continue talking with Dr. Michio Kaku, and the telephone lines are open, the flash line is open, and you can participate, 1-800-289-1092. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away.
You know, there's never been a better time for you to start your own broadcast. I know there are a lot of paranormal investigators. I know there are a lot of people who are paranormal experiencers who want to have their own broadcast. Well, now you can, right here at Steel Eye Media Network. It is within your grasp. You can do it, and we're waiting to hear from you. Give us a call today at 1-800-318-1008.
Call Kevin Smith at 1-800-289-1092.
We're talking with Dr. Michio Kaku, and we're talking primarily about his latest book called Physics of the Impossible. I highly recommend this book. I've just finished reading it. It is absolutely captivating. It will take your breath away as you read it. And if you are into the things that we talk about here on this show, you will love this book. Now, Dr. Kaku, one of the things that we talk about on this show has to do with paranormal things. That's one of the topics. And I am fond of saying, number one, I don't believe anything. Number two, that doesn't mean I disbelieve it. I don't know. That's why we question. That's why we investigate. I think that, for instance, I use the example, doorknobs do not require me to believe. They either exist or they don't. And I think that's the way a whole lot of paranormal phenomena is. It doesn't require us to believe. It requires investigation. And the second thing I say about it is that what we call paranormal, generally, that's simply something we really don't understand yet. We haven't figured out how it works yet, so we say it's paranormal. In your book, you address the issue of precognition. And you talk about various prophets from the past. You mentioned Nostradamus. You mentioned the book of Revelation in the Bible and its prophecies about the end of the world. And you talk about precognition. Is it possible for science to ever actually nail down the reality of that, whether it is or is not real? Is it possible for science to ever nail that down?
Well, I look at it this way. All physics can be summarized, I'm losing my voice, sorry, by two theories. One is the quantum theory, the theory of atomic physics, the theory of transistors, the internet, lasers. Most of what you see around you with iPods and TV sets is due to the quantum theory. And then the theory of the very big. Black holes, Big Bangs, Einstein's theory of relativity. Now, in both theories, we have something called causality, that if you have a cause, you have an effect and you have a cause. And so we have causality. Every effect you see had to be preceded by a cause. Now, precognition allows you to short-circuit that. And we once thought that these equations allowed for precognition. In Maxwell's theory, there's something called advanced waves rather than retarded waves. Advanced waves actually go into the future, which means that in principle, you could have a telephone conversation between the future and the past, which would be consistent with Maxwell's theory of electricity. That was very interesting, right? Mm-hmm. However, that loophole was closed in 1949. Sorry about that. A loophole was closed by Nobel Prize winner Richard Feynman. He showed that the advanced solutions, which seem to go forwards in time, allowing you to read the future, that is the behavior of antimatter. This blew people's minds when he discovered this, that when antimatter goes backwards in time, it's equivalent to matter going forwards in time. So these advanced waves are nothing but the waves emitted by antimatter. So causality was restored. And in fact, Feynman won the Nobel Prize in 1965. He won the Nobel Prize in part for the idea that matter going backwards in time is equivalent to antimatter going forwards in time. So causality was once again restored. Now, the lesson here is that every time we try to violate causality, it comes back. So at the present time, both the quantum theory and Einstein's theory allow for causality, except for time travel. Now, time travel is another loophole. But also in my book, I address several ways in which time machines may be compatible with causality. For example, if the river of time forks into two rivers, and then you go forwards or backwards in time and give prophecies and change the past, change the future, you are changing somebody else's past, somebody else's future. You are skipping from one river to another river, not your own river. Your river of time is fixed. So that's one way to violate causality, but in the final analysis, still preserve it, because you've influenced somebody else's universe.
All right, let's take our final call. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and where are you calling from? Ah, they hung up. All right, we have a couple of flash messages. One from Sweden. It says, have you experienced anything paranormal yourself? Have you seen anything or experienced anything that you could not explain?
Not personally. However, I get lots of emails from people who had strange experiences and have seen strange lights in the sky, and it would take too long to go through all of them. But, you know, as a scientist, I have to be open to all sorts of things, no matter how crazy.
All right.
So I get a lot of email.
This is from Alice in Kuwait. And she says, if the parallel universes are in my living room and sort of on a different frequency, when can I have a device like a video phone to interact with them? How feasible is that?
Well, at the present time, we know of no way to directly contact a universe that has decohered from us. Otherwise, we could bring back Elvis Presley, for example. However, that said, wormholes are one way to drill holes between universes. And in my book, Parallel Worlds and Physics of the Impossible, I actually give you a blueprint as to what a wormhole machine might look like. But again, this is for a very advanced civilization. You'd have to be quite more advanced than us in order to drill a hole between universes. But it could be possible.
Where can, and I really feel foolish asking this question, but I need to ask the question. I need to give you the opportunity to tell us, where can people get your book? I know the answer is everywhere, but how can they get your book?
Well, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders. Like I said, it hit the New York Times bestseller list this week, so it's in most bookstores, but Amazon is the simplest way to get a copy of the book.
On the cover of your book, there are scientific-looking equations, and then there is what looks like the TARDIS from Doctor Who.
That's right. That is the telephone booth from Doctor Who. Very good.
It looks like it's transporting from one wormhole into another.
Yeah, it's a telephone booth between universes. It's going from one universe to the next, and that's how Doctor Who does all his magic. He does all his magic through a wormhole. And so the cover of my book, Physics of the Impossible, is a wormhole connecting two universes.
Well, I have to use a very unscientific term here in describing it. It's just cool. I mean, if I walked through a bookstore and saw just the cover, I would have to have the book. That's fantastic.
When was the last time you saw a bestseller with a wormhole on the cover?
Well, that's true. Doctor, you've just returned from Japan. I know you've got a cold, and I know that it's been tough for you to be with us for 2 hours, but I got to tell you, it's been a joy, and I am just delighted that you've been with us. What is coming up next? Do you have some more TV appearances coming?
I've been working with the History Channel. I just did a taping with them about Einstein. Another one next week about parallel universes, in fact. A whole History Channel program about parallel universes. So like I said, this is not fringe anymore. Mainstream media is interested in this now.
All right. Well, thanks for being with us. If you will, just stay on the line with me here a few seconds as I close the show. It's been a joy, and I thank you, and I hope in the future we can have you again.
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Michio Okaku, and what a fascinating individual he is. And I got to tell you, I don't recommend a lot of books, but I recommend this one. You need to get it. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. I'll be back tomorrow night with Dr. Michael Sala, and you be here too, okay? Until then, so long, everybody.